محمد والوحي ربا.
Round the world with reporters.
Iran, Cuba, and Venezuela host a virtual seminar at the UN headquarters in Vienna on unilateral sanctions and their impacts in light of the COVID-19 pandemic. The three countries are under crippling US sanctions that have added extra pressure as they struggle to fight the coronavirus. Banking restrictions resulting from the sanctions are affecting the country's ability to obtain medical equipment, a point highlighted by the UN Special Rapporteur on the negative impact of unilateral coercive measures on the enjoyment of human rights. Iran's ambassador to international organizations in Vienna, Kazem Gharibabadi, said as the world's biggest imposer of unilateral sanctions, the US should be held accountable for the consequences of its actions.
These sanctions violate human rights in the current circumstances. In our country, we also face a problem in importing medicine and medical equipment from abroad as a result of these cruel, unilateral, coercive measures and banking restrictions. Those who impose these sanctions have international responsibilities.
The Cuban ambassador said many countries are unaware of the impact that these sanctions are having on countries' healthcare systems and people's normal day-to-day lives.
As a result of this seminar, we will try to impulse all declaration in all resolution of United Nations to include the request to the United States and the other country and the European country who impose unilateral coercive measure to lifting those measures as the Secretary General of the United Nations requests and the High Commissioner of Human Rights.
In a joint statement, representatives of 38 participating countries said unilateral coercive measures are against international law, human rights and the UN Charter.
Under the current circumstances caused by the coronavirus, they said, sanctions have made targeted countries vulnerable and need to be lifted. Homolezki, Vienna.
We are told that EU officials are monitoring the situation in the Middle East very closely as tensions escalate over the assassination last Friday of senior Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The 27-nation bloc's foreign policy spokesperson, Peter Stano, gave this reaction when we spoke to him via Skype.
What happened on Friday in the city of Abzaz is a criminal act and runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights for which the European Union is standing for.
One EU lawmaker says Israel orchestrated the attack under false pretenses and in cahoots with the Trump administration to try and scupper Joe Biden's plans to re-engage with Iran in 2021.
People should remember that Iran has no nuclear weapons, despite for the last 25 years Israel crying wolf that they could develop one. Israel has nuclear weapons. So, I mean, which is the bigger danger to peace in the region?
Political commentators say the EU has a pattern of issuing strongly worded statements, but will once again shy away from taking any firm steps against Israel. They say the bloc has turned a blind eye to repeated international law violations perpetrated by Israel and Saudi Arabia. Apparently, this is because the EU does not want to upset the United States. But also, trade in weapons and goods to these regimes is worth billions of euro annually. The big question now is, how might Tehran respond to Fakhrizadeh's murder? And what impact could any such response have on ambitions under a Biden presidency to save the Iran nuclear deal?
Tehran has always insisted its nuclear energy program is purely peaceful. Security analysts say the Israeli regime and the very powerful Israel lobby in Washington have shown time and time again the last thing in the world they want is peace with Iran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Minister's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill. Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian People was designated by the United Nations on November 29 in 1977. The day is marked every year internationally with rallies and activities aimed at drawing attention to the struggle of the Palestinian people. This year, a protest was held in the village of Khan al-Ahmar that is under a threat again to be demolished by the Israeli military. On this day, Palestinians assured they will continue to defend their lands amid calls by the Palestine Liberation Organization to enable the Palestinians to exercise their right to self-determination and their independent state.
We are still struggling to protect our basic rights against Israeli regime violence. Meanwhile, our dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. We have come here to voice our protest against Israel's aggression. We are the real owners of these lands.
This year, however, Palestinians say they were left alone struggling the Israeli occupation and its non-stop attempts to annex more lands, mainly after some Arab states have signed normalization deals with Tel Aviv. These ties, Palestinians say, simply undermine efforts for Palestinian state. Palestinian officials stress that what they see as a symbolic international solidarity has failed to give the Palestinian people their rights, while Israel continues to occupy most of the land of historical Palestine.
Israel will not be deterred by statements of condemnation. Israel can be stopped only by popular nonviolent Palestinian struggle and boycott, divestment, sanctions against its system of apartheid. That's what we want to see. BDS, not normalization with occupation.
The UN, meanwhile, has renewed commitment to the Palestinian people. However, its Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has cautioned that the prospects for a viable two-state solution are becoming more distant, mainly with Israel's expansion of illegal settlements, a significant spike in the demolition of Palestinian homes and structures, violence, and continued militant activity. After more than 40 years since the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people was designated by the UN, Palestinian rights remain usurped and the dream of an independent Palestinian state has not yet come true. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Venezuela's judiciary has convicted a group of former oil executives who plotted with the U.S. government against the interests of the South American country Citgo Petroleum Corporation, which is based in the United States. The judicial ruling comes at a time when Caracas is fighting to regain control of Citgo, as the company was illegally confiscated by the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump. Citgo's former executives were found guilty of passing secret information to American authorities in order to inflict damage on Venezuela's oil industry, a misconduct that is regarded as a major crime in Venezuela. In this scenario, officials support the judicial verdict.
The judge's decision is aimed at protecting our country's oil industry from U.S.-funded spies like ex-Citgo executives.
On the flip side, the opposition criticizes this legal case.
There is not enough evidence of conspiracy between the former executives and the U.S., so this court ruling is politically motivated.
Nonetheless, experts say the country's judiciary issued the right verdict.
The former executives are the Venezuelans who hold U.S. citizenship. That's a felony itself, in case you are the manager of a Venezuelan company.
Venezuela's judiciary has punished the former oil executives for their complicity with the U.S. Analysts say this is part of Caracas's legal actions to get back Citgo, the oil company that was illegally confiscated by Washington. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
A human tide, rarely seen, flooded in the streets of Paris and all over France in a freedom march against a new security law. The massive protest is held against President Macron's government that is pushing a new bill that restricts the ability to film police. Human rights associations and media are unanimous. This law would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
There's a huge popular opposition against this law. Even the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and other international bodies criticize it. A social majority in this country refuses the implementation of this law. Since a long time, we alert the government on police brutality and violence against women. Violence against women during the lockdown is exploding, and the government remains inactive and guilty.
Two major events this week plead in favor of the protesters and of the importance of video footage to denounce police violence. First, French police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris. The French government ordered an internal police investigation after police officers were filmed tossing migrants out of tents and intentionally tripping one while evacuating a protest camp.
It is important to film this kind of situations because it's part of freedom of expression. Filming with our phones is almost the only way of publishing this kind of violence against migrants, people from the suburb, against everybody.
And then a second video showed the violent arrest of a black music producer in Paris. Three police officers repeatedly punched and hit him during 20 minutes. The man told that the officers made racist insults.
Thanks to the images showing the beating by a kind of private militia attacking a music producer, the truth has come out. Without this video footage from a surveillance camera, the man would be in prison accused for using violence against the police. That shows the importance of having a counter power in this country.
Under a huge pressure, Interior Minister Darmanin announced disciplinary proceedings as soon as possible, but that might be too little, too late. In the meantime, the protest is going on.
A large majority in the French parliament voted in favor of the security law, but the Senate still has to approve it. Right-wing senators, a majority in the Senate, declared they will rewrite the law because it is unconstitutional. Chris Den Hont, Paris.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected prime minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which he led until his death, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
facing the loss of the Al-Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Ummah Party leader and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. This is it will be reflecting on all and hold the political process.
Imam Al-Sadiq is the greatest one in the Sudan, and this is era need him. Why? Because according to the government,
Al-Mahdi served as a prime minister in the mid-60s and again in the mid-80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989, which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, Al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of thought, politics, literature, and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Ummah Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics. We are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not al-Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The elected, the coming elected parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Al-Sadiq al-Mahdi in the normalization, against the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Muhammad Fazari, from Khartoum, Twin City of Omdurman.
At 2:30 p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept the car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, all electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created a void in Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. And to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in 8 phases ending on December 19th. A large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls in passed by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens. The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my bloc.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدَيْنِ إِحْسَانًا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. This is your host Ali Maytham and you're listening to IRIB English Radio and this is For Humanity. Well, in the previous episode we talked about the freedom of expression, the freedom of speech. But now in this one, we'll talk about the freedom of association. Islam has also given people the rights of freedom of association and formation of parties or organization. This is the right also subject to certain general rules. It should be exercised for propagating virtues and righteousness and should never be used for spreading evil and mischief. We also have been given this right for spreading righteousness and virtues, but have been ordered to exercise this, addressing the Muslims. The Holy Quran declares, "You are the best of community which has been brought forth for mankind. You command what is proper, forbid what is improper, and you believe in God." Chapter number 3, verse number 110. This means that it is obligated and duty of the entire Muslim community that it should invite and enjoin people to righteousness and virtues, forbid them from doing evil. If the entire Muslim community is not able to perform this duty, then let there be a community among you that will invite people to do good, command what is proper, and forbid what is improper. Those will be prosperous. Chapter number 3, verse number 104. This clearly indicates that if the entire Muslim nation collectively began to neglect It is obligation to invite people to goodness and forbid them from doing evil. Even it is absolutely essential that it should contain at least a group of people which may perform this obligation, has been said before. This is not only a right, but an obligation, and the fulfillment of which depends success and prosperity here as well as in the hereafter. It is irony that with a religion of God, that there's a Muslim country, the assembly and association that is formed for the purpose of spreading evil and mischief should be the right rule over the country and association and party which have been formed for propagating righteousness and virtue should live in perpetual fear and harassment and being declared illegal. Condition here are just the reverse of what has been prescribed by God. The claim that is, we are Muslims and this is an Islamic state, but the work that is being done directing to spreading evil, to corrupt, morally disgrace and disgrace the people, well, there is an active and effective check on the wrong and on the work being carried out, the reforming society, inviting people to righteousness. More the people of those who are engaged in spreading righteousness and checking the spread of evil and wickedness is made intolerable and hard to bear. Well, when you talk about the freedom of conscience and conviction, Islam has also given the right of freedom and conscience and conviction and its own citizen in the Islamic State. The Holy Quran has laid down the injunction. There should be no coercion in the matter of faith. Chapter number 2, verse number 256. Though there's a truth and virtue greater than the religion of true Islam, and the Muslims enjoin to invite and embrace Islam and advance argument in favor of it, they're not asked to enforce this faith on them. No force will be applied in order to compel them and accept Islam. Whosoever accepts it does not by his own choice. Muslim will welcome such a convert to Islam with open arms and admit him in the community with equal rights and privileges. But if somebody does not accept Islam, Muslim have to recognize and respect his decision, and no moral, social, and political pressure will be put on him to charge his mind. Let's take a break. We'll be right back and continue even further.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, before the break, we talked about the freedom of consension and conviction, that if you see that there is someone who's not willing to accept Islam, well, Islam says don't just force your religion to him, because there's no force in Islam. So protection of righteous sentiments. Yeah, Islam even talks about it. What do you think? Islam is just not like Western world. They don't talk about the human rights like hypocrisy. But Islam talks about everything in detail. Well, along with the freedom of conviction and freedom of conscience, Islam has given the right to individuals that the righteous sentiments will be given due respect and nothing will be said and done with which encroach upon his right. It has been ordered by Allah in the Holy Quran, do not abuse those who appeal to instead of God. Chapter number 6, verse number 108. These instructions are not only limited to idols and deities, but they also apply to the leaders of nation and heroes of the people. If a group of people holds a conviction which according to you is wrong, and holds certain person as high esteem which according to you is not deserved by them, then it will not be justified in Islam that you use abusive language for them and thus injure them with their feelings. Islam does not prohibit people from holding debates and discussion and righteous matter, but if it wants these discussions should be conducted in decency. Do not argue with the people of the book unless it is the politest manner. Chapter number 29, verse number 46. Says the Quran, this order is not merely limited to the people of scriptures, but applies with equal force to those following other faiths. Protection from adherity, imprisonment. When you talk about this, Islam has also recognized the rights of individuals that will be arrested and imprisoned for the offense to others. Though the Quran has laid down in this principle clearly, no bearer of burden shall be made bear and burden of another. chapter number 6, verse number 164. Islam believes in a person's responsibility. We ourselves are responsible for acts, and that the consequences of our actions cannot be transferred to someone else. In other words, this means that every man is responsible for his action. If another person has not shared his action, then has cannot be held responsible for it, cannot be arrested. It is a matter of great regret and shame that we're seeing. This is just an equitable principle that has not been framed by one human being, but the creator and the nourisher and the entire universe being flouted and violated before our eyes, so much so that a person is guilty for a crime and is a suspect, that his wife being arrested for his crime. Things have been gone so far that innocent people are being punished for the crime of others. To give a recent example, in a country, a man was suspected of being involved in bomb throwing incident. In the course of police investigation, he was subjected to horrible torture in order to extract a confession from him. When he insisted on his innocence, the police arrested his mother, his wife, his daughter, and sister, and brought them to police station. They were all stripped naked in presence, and he was stripped naked for his wife's clothes before his own eyes, and for the confession of the crime could extract it from him. And appears as a sake of investigation of crime, it has become proper and legal to our country to strip the innocent women folk and of the household in order to bring pressure on the suspect. This is indeed very outward and shameful. This is the height of meaningless and depravity. This is mere harshly, which has been repeated here, and I have full information about this case and can prove my allegation in the court law. I would here like to ask, what right such tyranny who prepared these crimes against mankind have to tell us that the Muslim or their the conduct the affairs of the state according to the teachings of Islam, and in their states of Islamic state, they're branching and flouting a fresh law of Old Quran. They're stripping men and women naked, which is strictly forbidden in Islam. They disgrace, humiliate humanity, and then they claim that they're what? A Muslim. Astaghfirullah. Well, that is it for today. Don't forget to visit our website, which is www.parstoday.com, and click on the tab Call of Islam, where you can find our programs as well as this one. And you can email us and contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. With that being said, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasooli wa alin nabiyyil azim. Allahumma salli wa sallim ala rasooli wa alin nabiyyil azim. اللهم صل وسلم على الرسول وآل النبي العظيم.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Muhammad bin Salman. His name is now more conspicuously tied to the slaying of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi and spearheading the bloody war in Yemen. But that's not what he wanted to be known for in the first place. A few years before he came to power as the Saudi crown prince and the de facto leader of the kingdom in 2017, he established a charity by the name of MISC, or Prince Mohammed bin Salman bin Abdulaziz Foundation, a non-profit foundation with the stated goal of cultivating and encouraging learning and leadership in youth for a better future in Saudi Arabia. MISC was in fact central to the so-called MBS project, aimed at promoting bin Salman as a compassionate leader who cares for the well-being of others. Much to the dismay of the young crown prince, Misk is now engulfed in a spate of scandals, including the Khashoggi hit. The foundation came under suspicion following a lawsuit filed in the U.S. last November, according to which MISC's former Secretary General, Badr al-Assakr, had interactions with two former Twitter employees, namely Ali al-Zabara and Ahmed Abu Amr, both accused of spying on private user data of some Saudi dissidents and passing it to Riyadh. The suit asserted that al-Assakr had provided gifts, cash payments, and promises of future employment in exchange for non-public information about Twitter users. The two employees, along with Ahmed al-Mutairi, who then worked for the Saudi royal family, tapped data from 6,000 Twitter accounts in the years 2014 and 2015. The aim was to identify, and needless to say, to punish some of the Saudi dissidents who would criticize the kingdom's ruling family on the social media platform. The three men all worked for al-Assakr, who was back then in charge of bin Salman's charity foundations, with a small fortune in his pocket. But that was not the first and last time al-Assakr, who still continues to have a senior role at MISC, hit the headlines for his non-philanthropic work. Just a few weeks after the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, the Turkish newspaper Yeni Safak ran the story that the Saudi intelligence officer at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul called al-Assakr four times the day Khashoggi was killed.
Mohammed bin Salman is not only the absolute ruler of Saudi Arabia, meaning that he controls everything from the functions of the state to murders that are carried out, assassinations that are carried out, to the charitable trusts. And we shouldn't be surprised at all that he is still busy trying to brutally murder people. Mohammed bin Salman has not been held accountable in any way for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, and we're right now at the anniversary of that.
Critics say beneath the surface of MISC and gentle appearance of its former Secretary General, who happens to head bin Salman's private office, lie dark secrets that dovetail with the Saudi Crown Prince's real image, not the one burnished by his spin doctors. In the words of director of Freedom Forward, Sanjeev Berry, the Crown Prince and his henchmen keep trying to present themselves in a positive light. Yet behind the scenes, they spy on dissidents' Twitter accounts and are willing to take a bone saw to anyone who disagrees with them. Initially, a number of big names like the United Nations, the Gates Foundation, Bloomberg, Harvard University, and General Electric sealed partnerships with MISC. But in the wake of the Khashoggi killing, more of them, like the Gates Foundation and Harvard University, cut ties with it.
Mohammed bin Salman, since he came into power, has been trying to sell us an image of himself, like a Disney World version of a Saudi crown prince, one who is a reformer, one who is bringing his country into modern era, but in reality he is a brutal dictator who has created the worst humanitarian crisis on the planet in Yemen, who chops up the bodies of journalists, who imprisons women for speaking out against him or for speaking out, calling for their rights. And so, you know, he's trying to present this Disneyland image, but especially after Khashoggi's murder and looking at heroes like Lujain al-Hakluel, who remains imprisoned in Saudi Arabia, we easily see through him, see through this image, and see him for the brutal, bonesaw, misogynist dictator that he is.
The scandalous story of Misk reached its crescendo in August this year, when former Saudi intelligence officer Saad al-Jabri filed a lawsuit in the U.S., alleging that the Saudi crown prince plotted to assassinate him by sending a 50-person kill team dubbed the Tiger Squad a few weeks after the killing of Khashoggi. According to al-Jabri, Misk conspired with al-Sakr and bin Salman to covertly recruit individuals to serve as agents and who participated in the hunt for him on U.S. and Canadian soil. The hitmen were offered employment at Minsk as a reward for aiding the Crown Prince and Mr. al-Sakr. Concerns about the so-called charitable foundation intensified in September 2017, when people from Minsk repeatedly asked one of Jabri's sons for contact details of Jabri himself and his wife, as well as about their residency status in the United States.
So as Mohammed bin Salman is trying to paint himself as this modernizer, as this reformer, we are continuing to expose the Saudi regime for the brutal dictatorship that it is, for the war crimes that it commits. Saudi Arabia this year is hosting the G20 forum, but across the board, mayors of cities across America and across the world who have been invited are canceling. And they are canceling because of the imprisoned women, because of the brutal crackdowns on journalists, on dissidents, because of the brutal war in Yemen.
The Misk case begs this question. If Saudi officials can run spy rings, dismember a journalist, and dispatch a kill team all under the guise of a charity, what can they not do in an all-out military conflict like the Yemen war? Whether these are just the tip of the iceberg or not, Misk Foundation, first and foremost, embodies the Saudi duplicity entrenched in the kingdom's ruling family, where things are not really what they seem.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is Muslim Lady from IRIB English Radio, and our info is based on tradition. Today, we're going to continue the discussion on modesty. And we have in our studio Sister Salma Khalfan, who is in fact my aunt. Welcome to the program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for inviting me over. Inshallah, we will have a nice discussion about women, get to know each other better also in the process.
Inshallah. Thank you so much. So in our previous program, we were talking about modesty and chastity and hijab. And we heard some very beautiful traditions from the Prophet and Imam Ali, one of which was saying that modesty is the whole of religion, just to, you know, amplify the importance and the magnanimity of, you know, modesty and what it really is. You spoke a lot about modesty, and it really, I felt, made me feel that we really have to try and work hard on ourselves, us who we feel that we are already wearing our hijab. That is not the only thing. There is so much modesty, like it has its roots to everything. So you are going to continue with us, inshallah, a bit more on this.
Yes, today I would like to talk about the importance of this hijab itself, okay? So to see how important it Islam gives hijab in the Sharia. Okay. It is enough to see how other rules and regulations are also modified to change and preserve this principle of hijab.
Okay.
Yeah, other rules and regulations in the Sharia. So, for example, number one, praying in the mosque is better than in the house, of course.
Yeah.
You know that. And its reward goes on increasing as the gathering of the jama'ah increases the congregation.
Very true.
But for the women, the opposite is correct. Why? To preserve their hijab. There is more reward in house and in the veranda of the house rather than going to the mosque. Why? Because she would be looked at probably. But yeah, if she knows that she has a mosque very much nearby, she would be looked at. So that's another thing. But mostly it happens so that men and women are mixed in the road, right?
Yeah.
So,
or for instance, when she's going to the mosque and there are many men waiting outside, you know, going inside, and she so she has to like judge it by herself. Now, right now, for instance, in Qum, when we want to go to namaz in Haram, it is different, I guess, because everyone is covered. Everyone, it's a known place. We're all going to the Haram for ziyarah.
There are different entrances for both men and women.
Exactly.
So it does play a role. But yeah, mostly it's the opposite. For women to pray at home is more thawab, and it becomes a mosque for her.
Okay.
Yeah? So it's very good. So this the Sharia also, see how it is modified.
Yeah.
Then there's another law, that is the Adhan and Iqama, before the daily five prayers are very much emphasized.
Yeah.
But women are exempted from it. If they opt to say Adhan and Iqama, of course they can do so in their own homes when there's no ghayri mahram to hear their voice. But otherwise, they're not allowed. They're only allowed to whisper it.
Okay.
It's so much sawab, you know, for Adhan and Iqama to be recited. It's like there's a congregation of angels behind you from the earth to the skies. The distance is so long.
Subhanallah.
And they pray behind a person who recites Adhan and Iqama loudly.
Yeah.
That's very good. But for a woman, she has to take care that
she has to try and recite it slowly.
Yeah. And if she's at home where there's no mahram, ghayri mahram, na mahram, then it's okay. She can recite it. But we don't see women doing it in mosques, do we?
No,
never,
no, we don't.
Right? And then another law is that it is wajib, incumbent for men to recite the first two rakats of Fajr, Maghrib and Isha, the sets of prayer, loudly, the first two sets of prayer.
Okay.
The Surah Al-Hamd and the But women are required to pray in whispers only.
Mm.
So that is also one. Another law is Friday prayer is wajib aini, like it has to be done in the presence of imam or his appointed deputy.
The emphasis is greater for men.
Yeah, but women are exempted from this wajib. All
so
in all,
even if imam will come,
we
are not. It's not going to be completely wajib for us to pray.
Yeah, they're exempted from it because of their chastity, of course.
Mm.
And then there's ghusl mayyit. It is important that the person giving the funeral bath be a Muslim. But if a Muslim woman dies and they are male ghayri mahram Muslims and female Christians, then the Christian woman should be asked to take a bath, give ghusl to the Muslim women.
Oh.
That much important it is that a woman only should see a woman.
See a woman, and not a man.
But of course, another alim, Muhakkik Hilli, does not agree with this. He says that the ghusl mayyat is an ibadah and it needs intention of kurbatan ilallah, which from a kafir is not correct. So non-Muslim women cannot give a Muslim woman this funeral bath. So instead of allowing Muslim men should give her ghusl, he says that the dead body should be buried without the ghusl.
Oh.
Yeah, that much so. So the chastity of the woman is maintained, of course, yeah?
Yeah. By mahram, you mean those people who are...
Who are close relatives to her, closely connected to her. Blood relatives, like, and they are specific ones, like the uncles from both the parents' side.
Okay.
And the father, the husband,
so the mother's
the
brother, or the father's brother.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Not cousins, or the brother's children, your niece, your nephews. Those are mahram. Because,
yeah, those are mahram.
Yeah. And now mahram are those who are... For instance, your mother's sister's husband. That is yeah. A mahram.
Mahram comes from the haram. Haram is when you live together under one roof.
Your clothes, complete
close,
family.
And also you share secrets.
Yeah, okay.
But there could be nothing better for a woman to give a woman a ghusl. Or, of course, the spouses to each other. And then there's a great reward in carrying the bier of a Muslim. That is the tabut of a Muslim.
Or the coffin.
Yeah, the coffin. And walking in his funeral or the procession of the funeral. But women, again, are exempted from that.
Okay.
Yeah. Exempted as in she will get the same sawab for it.
Okay.
So whether, even she likes it, sometimes women will feel like going.
She would like to go, but yeah. If she doesn't go.
Because of the fact that she will come across many men and they might even, you know, push her or, you know, like touch her or something like that, by mistake even, it's good to avoid such situations.
Okay.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
And then another law is, in ihram, the woman is not allowed to cover her face. But as Muhakkik Thani Karaki has written, this rule does not mean being seen by ghayr mahram is allowed. Ayatollah Abul Qasim Al-Khuri writes that when the woman wants to hide herself from ghayr mahram in ihram, she may pull down a corner of her ihram on her face and chin, but it is ahwat, better and more precautionary, that she put her hand on some other thing to keep the cloth away from her face. So in ihram also,
like, these exemptions have come that if she wants to cover her face, yeah, there are ways of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though it's not allowed to really cover, but for women it's exempted. Yeah.
It. And then last but not least, jihad, that is fighting the way of Allah, is the most liked ibadah, the act of worship. But women are exempted from the fighting, and the best jihad of a woman is to take care of her husband.
Okay.
So this is the way, in the confinement of the home, she can do her jihad. And of course, the greater jihad is for everyone, and that's the nafs, yeah?
Yeah, jihad with the nafs.
Yeah. I'd also like to point out about the ideal hijab according to some traditions, the ideal hijab. So the ultimate or the ideal hijab may be understood from these traditions that I'm quoting. Hijab means cover, right?
Covering.
Yeah, covering, yeah. Here we're talking about the outward ideal hijab. So we can understand this from the following traditions. One is that when the Holy Prophet was in his house and Umm Salma's and Maymuna's house, a blind companion, Abdullah ibn Maktoum, he sought permission to come to the Holy Prophet's house. So the Prophet ﷺ told the above mentioned mothers of the believers, that is Umm Salma and Maymuna, to hide themselves. So they said, but he is blind.
Yeah.
So the Prophet said, are you also blind?
Uh-huh.
Would you not see him?
Yeah.
So here, what is it saying? That you see, the actual ideal hijab is a woman even doesn't see a man, and a man even doesn't see him. That's why the Quranic ayat stresses, kullil mu'minat yaghudna min absarihinna.
Yeah. It's like, even if he's blind, but just coming in front of an mahram and not being in a modesty, like in a modest manner, it's just not very proper.
Yeah, and even it kind of gives this sense to women that don't think that if you're in hijab now you can do whatever you want.
Mm.
You have to even lower your eyes, right?
Yeah, right.
So we have to try to practice this, I think, to lower our eyes, however funny it appears to me. But when you're talking to men, a bit lower our gaze. But if it's very important and you have to see, then you have to speak with a serious tone. And of course, you have to not ever have the intention of all any other than, you know, like what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Then there's another tradition of Imam Ali alayhi salam, who said that once a blind man in company of the Holy Prophet, asked permission of Fatima, Hazrat Fatima to Zahra, to enter her house. So she stopped him until she covered herself. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Why did you stop him? He cannot see you." This was just a test, of course. He knew his daughter, right?
Yeah.
So she said, "Although he cannot see me,
I
can see him. And moreover, if I don't hide, he might feel my scent."
Oh.
Yeah. So that smell even is very important, that sometimes a woman naturally has a good scent. And of course, what to speak of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, who's the Lady of Heaven.
Yeah, definitely.
So the Holy Prophet said, "I bear witness that you are a part of me."
SubhanAllah. Yeah.
That much he was so happy and proud of his daughter to show this kind of moral behavior in her. Then there's another tradition. It's very important, you see. This gives us the ideal hijab.
And they're so beautiful to hear.
Yeah, because of all Ahlul Bayt, of course.
Yes.
So once the Holy Prophet asked her, that is Bibi Fatima Zahra, what is the best for a woman? Best for a woman.
Yeah.
So she replied that she does not see a man and no man sees her. So the Prophet said, offspring one from the other. Huh? That she does not see a man and no man sees her. So this can be, for example, applied to us also. That if we avoid our gazes, so when will the man see us?
Yeah.
Right? We should avoid the gaze so that the man cannot be interested to seeing us. Unless we come and we straightly see a man
and
gaze or talk or want to talk or start a conversation, that's when the man will want to even reply, right?
Exactly. And it just shows that there is really no need for doing this. Why should we want to do it? I guess Bibi Fatima is trying to tell us, look, this is something that shouldn't be done, Aslan.
More so, it shouldn't be done.
Yeah. So if it's done, it should be because of a very important reason.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why Islam encourages that, you know, women should be even professionally acquainted with the jobs of women.
Yeah.
For example, in a school or girls, they should be a person who's so educated that she can be a headmistress, right?
Yes.
Or a gynecologist woman. She's needed, right?
Yeah.
So this is to encourage her that you are also socially acceptable. You can even contribute to the society.
Very true.
But you don't need to intermingle with men apart from the people who is very important or who are your mahram. So this shows that this is also one of the ideal hijab that I feel can be practiced even today. And that's why it's makruh for a man to do salam to a woman, you know?
Yeah.
He wants to raise a conversation. Salam is also like a warmth, a kind of a gesture of warmth. Peace be on you. You know, it shows kind of an affection, right? So he doesn't want to show that he has the affection even the least bit to a woman.
I guess that's all the time that we have. Inshallah, till our next episode, we hope to continue this. Thank you very much. And thank you, dear audience, for listening. God bless you all. And fi amanillah.
Who is the Lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
www.parstoday.com/en